I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. Last week, we featured Maryland House of Delegates leaders David Moon and Mark Corman talking mainly about the state's difficult fiscal situation. This week, we have leaders from the state Senate, Brian Feldman and Jim Rosapep, respectively chair of the Education, Energy and Environment Committee, and vice chair of the Senate's Budget and Taxation Committee. Governor Westmore is expected to present his budget on January 15th, and that will set the stage for a real debate for how to manage the balance between new taxes and new spending cuts. As a reminder, Maryland has a $3 billion structural deficit. The state has a rainy day fund that it can raid, some monies it has committed to capital projects that it can claw back. There may be some spending cuts or delays, including to the big-ticket education law called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the 1920s. Song recordings and films from a century ago just entered the public domain on January 1st. The song you're listening to now is As American as Mom and Apple Pie. Singing in the Rain first appeared in the Hollywood Review of 1929. Lyrics by Arthur Freed and music by Nacio Herb Brown. Jim Rosapep, Brian Feldman, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thank you.
Thanks for the invite.
Last week on the show, House Majority Leader David Moon and Environment and Transportation Committee Chair Mark Corman called on their governing partners, including the Senate, to come forward and resolve the budget deficit, including possibly revenue increases. How do you see it? Maybe we can start with Senator Rosapep, since you are on budget and taxation.
Sure. I mean, I think we agree. I mean, we have a significant budget problem for the first time in a few years. We got to deal with it. The governor is going to come in with a balanced budget. We'll look at what he proposes in terms of spending reductions and revenue increases, and then we'll go from there.
Senator Feldman?
One of the concerns I have about where we're facing is, and last year we went through this, you know, the House sent the Senate a bill and it went to Senator Rosapep's committee in a $1.3 billion tax increase. Look, the reality is we're not going to be able to cut our way out of this problem entirely. But boy, we better be careful when, you know, the House sent us a $1.3 billion tax package. That's not going to spur economic growth relative to Virginia, Pennsylvania, and other states. We already have this branding problem of, again, overregulated, overtaxed, expensive place to do business. And I'll throw energy policy in there because of dealing with energy costs of this state. That's going to be a huge issue this session as well.
And with all due respect to that argument, I mean, that's what Larry Hogan, as governor, was going to fix. He was going to hold down taxes. He was going to cut tolls. He was going to make Maryland so competitive. The years where we had slow growth was during the Hogan administration. because that kind of strategy didn't work. That didn't grow the economy. We got to think a little bit bigger about how we grow the economy than holding down taxes.
Not to pick on Governor Hogan, but one thing Governor Hogan did do was he lowered the tolls. That cost us $500 million in that transportation trust fund. So, yeah, that was politically popular. I hear the slogan, but I don't think there were policies behind what that slogan about Maryland's open for business, whatever. But that $500 million, man, I really wish we had that $500 million right now to solve some of our transportation woes. I hear what Senator Rosapep says, but I would maintain relative to Virginia in particular, we do have a reputation and brand as a difficult place to do business regulatory-wise and an expensive place to do business.
You said that we can't cut our way through this, right? And $1.3 billion is too large. What do you think is a reasonable number for the revenue side?
I don't think we can get a good handle on that until we see the governor's budget. Because the governor is going to submit a balanced budget, and he's going to make some very important decisions about what he wants to do on the spending side. And there are lots of ins and outs in that. And I think we need to wait and see what he proposes. I presume he's going to propose some revenue as well, but I don't know that for a fact. Call me back in 2 weeks and we can talk about numbers.
Actually, January 15th is the date. And the budget this year, correct me if I'm wrong, Jim, starts on the House side. So we're going to have, by the time that budget comes from the governor through the House and comes to Senator Rosapep's committee, we're going to have, I think, a framework of what's on the table. And I think there's room for compromise between the House and the Senate. We will get it done. And I think even before it hits the Budget and Tax Committee, I think there will be a lot of conversations. I don't think, and by the way, you said $1.3 billion. I mean, it's a $3 billion structural deficit. We're not cutting $3 billion. So there's going to have to be some revenues in the mix. I mean, I absolutely, concede that point for sure.
I don't think we're going to get unanimity out of the Senate or the House this year. It's easy for Republicans to vote for budgets that don't have any hard decisions involving revenue. But politically, it's very hard for Republicans to vote for any revenue. And they're already signaling that they're going to play politics with this. So I'd love to have a unanimous vote in the Senate on the budget this year, but I'm not cashing that check.
One thing I'd be interested for Senator Rosapep's perspective would be, we do have this $2.5 billion rainy day fund. This is, according to the budget analysis, the worst situation we've had in 20 years. I mean, it's kind of a rainy day. Of that $2.5 billion, Jim, what would you suggest is an appropriate amount to tap that? And, that's a painless way to make the problem a little bit smaller.
I hate to sound like a fiscal conservative than I am, but I think we should minimize what we use the rainy day fund for this year. And in fact, the past 2 years, I was for putting more in the rainy day fund than we ended up doing, because the rainy day fund is there for once we get to a recession, when people are getting laid off work, when our unemployment rate goes up, when more people need to get on Medicaid, when more people need help. And I've been through this before. You've been through this before as well, Brian. And this is not a rainy day. This is a budget imbalance that we can talk about how it came about. I'd like to do that if you're interested. But this is not what the rainy day fund was set up for. The rainy day fund was set up for we have an economic crisis. And this is not an economic crisis because of Joe Biden's good work. We have a low unemployment rate in Maryland and elsewhere in the country. So this is not a rainy day. I would not take money out of the rainy day fund.
Can I just add one other thing on the cuts side things? Senator Rosapep is a former member of the University of Maryland Board of Regents. And I did, my committee, it's not just K-12, we have jurisdiction over higher ed. And I met with the university system in Maryland, all the 12 institutions, and they're prepared to, I think they've basically been told they're going to face some potentially 5% cuts across the board. So when we talk about an educated workforce and all that kind of thing, I mean, that's going to be painful. And Jim probably could speak to it even better than me, but they are very concerned about prospective cuts, again, in higher ed in our state. And it's to the tune of like 5%. So,
I mean, the one thing I would say, though, is one of the reasons we're in this situation is because we had 2 years of huge budget surpluses, both because of the federal aid, the ARPA legislation in 2021, and because of the boom in the economy. And it came back so fast and people went back to work and incomes went up, and the stock market went up. That all created 2 years of budget surpluses. And I think it's fair to say, not everyone will necessarily agree with me, that during the fat years, we were very generous with lots of programs, including the university system, frankly. And I would argue that the chickens are coming home to roost, and we're going to have to make some tough decisions.
The Spending Affordability Committee has said that you can draw down the rainy day fund from 10% to 7.5%. Does that make sense, or do you think we'll end up going to 5%, which is the statutory requirement?
I have no idea, truthfully. I mean, that's why I say we're going to have to see how it plays out, what the governor proposes. But the problem with taking from the rainy day fund, it's a one-time solution, because the projected deficits are not a one-time deficit. They're basically projected deficits as far as the eye can see. Therefore, as you talked earlier, the economic growth is long-term, but fixing the budget problem is a long-term issue too. And short-term quick fixes are better than no fixes. But I would hope that we're going to make some longer-term structural decisions. That's why I call it a structural deficit. It's not a cyclical deficit.
What do you think is a structural fix from your point of view?
I think we need to look at the buckets of major state investment that we have. And the big one is education. Then healthcare, and education, I mean K-12, separate is higher education. Then is Medicaid. The Medicaid one is particularly difficult because the reason the Medicaid costs have gone up so much is because of inflation that's affected everything else. It's affected healthcare inflation, and that was unexpected, and that's, therefore it costs more. But we also have the Trump administration and the Republicans in control in Washington who have tried over decades to cut Medicaid. And that's one of the things I'm very, very worried about, is the uncertainties related to what the Republicans will do in Washington is a big variable that we're not going to know much about for a while. But I think we will know a good bit by the time we get to finalizing our budget in March and April. The last time, I believe it was the last time during the Trump administration, but it certainly was during the Bush administration, they tried to turn federal Medicaid funding into a block grant, which means that if more people got sick and more people were poor and needed health care in a state, the state would have to come up with all the money. That would be a revolutionary change in Medicaid, and that's a real danger. So we need to do it with a short-term issue, but we need to be thinking long-term as well.
So you think those areas, Medicaid, education, higher ed, those several buckets that you just mentioned, there need to be cuts there right now in order to address the long-term structural issue?
We need to figure out how we're going to finance this thing long-term. I mean, transportation, I didn't mean to leave out transportation that Brian mentioned. That's exactly correct, too, is because I want to come back to the Hogan years. Because the Hogan years had no interest in the long-term, was all about this messaging about how we're holding down your taxes and don't worry about the fact that we don't have enough state troopers. Don't worry that we don't have enough folks fixing our highways. We're paying the cost of those Hogan years. It's catching up with us, and so it's going to be difficult, but it's doable.
I'm hearing taxes
for sure from the governor, from the leadership in both houses. Absolutely. I mean, okay. When people say you can't do it all with cuts, that means you got to do something with revenue.
Coming back to the Learman report, when we talk about a 1.6% GDP growth from 2016 compared to the national number of 13.9%, or Virginia at 11.2, or Pennsylvania 6.6. I'm hung up about that issue because partly growing the economy does ultimately help solve some of our budget problems long term. And so I'm hoping that we don't do harm to sort of writing the ship on that front. And I'll add that Montgomery County is even in a worse place from a regional standpoint comparatively to Northern Virginia. And I that's hard to explain either.
So in your view, what has caused this and how are you fixing it?
Well, I'm raising the issue because I think the debate this session will largely just talk about a lot of revenue increases. It's going to be politically challenging, but I hope it's not all on the backs of tax increases on ordinary Marylanders. I think there is opportunities. There is some things. There are some corporate loopholes out there. There are some sin taxes. I myself was the sponsor last in 2023 of the cannabis legalization bill, which is bringing billions of dollars. I don't recall if Senator Ospep was that supportive of that. But we have the lowest tax rate in the nation on cannabis sales. Bill and Senator Ospep's committee, dealing with gaming, iGaming. You had a bill last session that would produce $300 million. Internet gambling, I don't know how many dozens of other states are already doing it. I mean, I think we need to get a little creative more just on the revenue side of things, not just immediately look at income taxes, whether it's corporate income taxes or individual income taxes. I think I come back to this brand problem. Hopefully this executive order that the governor just released about red tape and too much regulation, I think it seems well thought through a bit. I'm hoping that yields some results. There are sectors that we have to get into the game on. My committee spent a tremendous amount of time last session on data centers. Do we want to have a digital economy in the state? Or are we going to cede to Loudoun County in Northern Virginia a modern digital economy? And we have not. We had one data center wanted to get going in Frederick, and it was one of the most hotly debated bills in my committee last session. And so we're going to have to, move into the modern world on some of this stuff. And we've been slow to the punch.
On the data center issue, what are the primary benefits to a state to have these data centers? Property taxes, obviously, and especially property taxes in places where property taxes are lower relative, maybe agricultural use. That's one thing. And then you'll have some jobs, but not too many. You'll have some construction employment. Is there anything else?
There's a reason my home state, Pennsylvania, is Lord Microsoft data center. They're opening up Three Mile Island there because they want a data center. There's reasons why states are trying to lure them. It's getting more sophisticated. If a data center wants to come to your state and you know that how much energy they're going to consume and some of the downside, environmental and otherwise, what kind of price are they going to pay? So some states are imposing some fairly heavy tariffs. Ohio's looking at some proposals that says you want to do, even in the bill last session in Maryland on the Frederick project, we said if you want to locate a data center, 15% of the revenue is going to have to be rededicated to clean energy project. That was an amendment we put on at the last second. So these are, I would say, deep-pocketed industries that if they want to do business in the state of Maryland, they're going to have to pay the piper. And I'd say that whether it's Microsoft or Amazon, which would like to come down to Calvert Cliffs and have a co-location agreement near our nuclear power plant, Amazon or Microsoft can sure pay the piper to operate in our state. So I don't think it's the workforce angle. It's that they produce a lot of revenue and they want to do business in our state for a reason.
But that revenue is not coming to you. They're not paying income taxes until you do combined returns.
Well, that's another issue on the table. Okay, these are, you've now thrown into a bunch of, tax policy issues about combined reporting and the like. I'm saying that the states are now saying to these folks, if you want to locate a data center here, you're going to have to figure out where are we going to get the power to power you up, but also there's going to be a price to pay.
Senator Roosevelt?
Yeah, I just wanted to bring it back to some of the tax issues you were raising. I mean, you mentioned combined reporting in passing. I thought that's an interesting example because we're way behind the rest of the country in implementing combined reporting. Texas has had combined reporting for 40 years. And so the idea that closing these corporate tax loopholes is a bad thing instead of a good thing, I think is wrong, is we've let too many big corporations not pay their fair share of taxes in Maryland. And that should stop for reasons of equity as well as raising revenue. So that's one point. Secondly, I agree with Brian 100%. We do not need or want to raise income taxes on ordinary people. But our income tax system is not as progressive as it could be. And making our income tax system more progressive, there are very specific proposals out there that members of the House have proposed, members of the Senate have proposed, that I think absolutely should be on the table. And then finally, mentioned climate change. There are several states, I saw New York just did it, I think Vermont has done a couple of others, which is make the big oil companies pay for the climate change they've caused. That's real money. And oil companies for decades have paid lower taxes than ordinary people. And that's partly because of lack of combined reporting and other things.
Of course, that's a triple E issue. And we did have a bill called the Renew Act last session, which is going to be brought back, I think, this session. One of the issues that came up at the hearing is, does that money that we're hitting those companies with just get passed through to regular middle-class folks?
There's a bill that was pre-filed that seeks to create different property classes in order to have a somewhat of a progressive property tax system. Where are you on that?
That's a B&T issue. by the way.
We had to step aside.
That's for local government again. That's been proposed over the years. Other states have it. It's a perfectly reasonable thing to discuss. I thought we were going is another proposal, which would be to allow increase in the property tax rates on undeveloped property near metro stops. Looking at our property tax is not one size fits all, and working it into our actual development strategy, I think makes a lot of sense. And I think the issue you're raising is part of that discussion.
Virginia has that model in place currently, and again, not perceived as anti-business. But when those proposals have been put on the table in the past, in fact, they've been Montgomery County local delegation bills at times, because County Executive Elrich has been talking about that proposal, I think, for several years. They've met resistance even in the Montgomery delegation. We kind of skirted over transportation, but maybe we should have not the state of Maryland paying for, you know, all the mass transit system, you know, the DC Metro and the Baltimore Metro mass transit system is all state responsibility, as opposed to all these projects being done on a regional basis or through a regional transportation authority. Maryland's model is unique in the nation. And so I just put that out there. If we start to talk about some creative ideas that ultimately could save the state money, it may end up costing maybe the locals more.
It seems that the locals have somewhat of a more better, relatively, situation fiscally. Do you think shifting the burden to the locals is one answer here?
Well, let me pick up on that issue, because Brian made a very good point about how we fund transportation. Is that's what I hope we'll be dealing with this session, thinking long term and not thinking short term. We got a short term problem, we got to deal with a short term problem. Should mass transit in the Washington area be financed by regional revenue sources the way Virginia does it? And should funding for education, and that includes the blueprint, includes higher ed, be done in different ways? Very people know this, but the university system of Maryland has no mandatory funding in the state budget. Every year, the governor and the legislature decide how much we're going to give the university system of Maryland. In contrast, the community colleges and the private colleges have a formula that say they get X percent of what the university system of Maryland gets. As a political compromise struck years ago, those kinds of issues, I think, need to be rethought for the longer term. And this is an opportunity to do it, maybe not all this year, but given that we have projected deficits that get worse when the blueprint increments click in FY28, it's these couple of years where we need to think about making the system more resilient fiscally.
Let's talk about housing. So one of the big levers on which Governor Moore has hung his hopes on for a revived economy is housing, and in particular, affordable housing. Is it moving fast enough?
I think it's too early to say. This year, the governor is going to be bringing a bill dealing with targets, specific targets. I haven't seen that the actual language yet. I suspect that there will be pushback from the locals. I'll just make a broad philosophical point. I'm just a little skeptical about how much government can actually drive the market, you know, in this arena and solving how housing is expensive in the DC area. Like, I'm not sure government can solve it. County Executive Elrich had talked about, you know, rent control, other kinds of proposals that can oftentimes have the opposite effect from what is intended. And so I'm open-minded. We passed the bill the governor put in place last year. We are going to take a fresh look at the new bill dealing with, whatever form it takes. I'm not sure, quite frankly, if it will have the intended result of actually providing a more housing stock, solve that 96,000 unit shortage, or have the impact of increasing supply to the point where by increasing supply, you're bringing down housing costs. I mean, if the theory, I'm just not sure that government can solve all those problems.
Senator Roosevelt?
I'd look at it more from the point of view of people being able to afford housing. I'm not sure it's a big budget strategy. And obviously, if you're building more housing, that's generating economic activity. I guess I do think that the state historically has not had much of a strategy on housing other than low-income housing. And that's important, but that's not most housing. And so I think it's a new thing, really, for a governor and a state, or in the state of Maryland, to think of housing strategy broadly. And I think that's important. That's, again, goes back to my broken record about thinking long term. not going to solve the housing problem in the next 6 months, but the housing problem was created after the collapse, you know, the financial crisis. I mean, that's what happened. There was a, you know, housing bubble in the early 2000s, a disaster, particularly in Prince George's County, and across the nation. And then as a result, the financing for housing collapsed and people building housing collapsed. And so now we have a shortage of housing. And I didn't see, frankly, and it may have been going on, I just didn't notice it. I didn't notice the federal government or the state government 10 years ago paying a whole lot of attention. And that comes back to my old friend, Governor Larry Hogan, paying a lot of attention to the shortage of housing. And now I'm glad to see the governor is paying attention to it.
The biggest single relevant factor to new construction of housing is mortgage rates. We're pushing now 7%. You know, during the pandemic, it was, you know, mid twos or three, if you were lucky. But that drives, you know, construction of housing or affordability of housing. And that I just, you know, that's a macroeconomic conversation. That's not going to be controlled in Annapolis or anywhere else. That's my skepticism kind of in a nutshell.
Yeah, it's interesting that the governor has hung his coat on this, right? Okay, how about clean energy? That's another thing that is sort of central to trying to spur growth.
I think after the budget, this will be the biggest issue I think we're going to confront. Definitely my committee. I know you did actually an episode, I think, on this subject. And all these issues come to the EEE committee. Look, we right now are already 40% importer. In other words, 40% of the energy we consume in Maryland comes from out of state. And that's presenting a whole bunch of challenges. We just don't generate. So we have all these ambitious goals, a lot of those goals on greenhouse gas emissions, climate change. We're electrifying buildings, homes, the transportation sector with electric vehicles. And we've tried to go big on renewable energy and all the rest. But, you know, the reality is, and then this is before if we get no data centers, but the data center thing even complicates stuff more. So while this is all happening, we're trying to close coal-fired power plants. I mean, not we. The economics of coal have shifted. So we've got Brandon Shores and others in the close. So we have this situation where this 40% number is actually increasing up the other way, and that presents a problem. We just need more in-state generation. So this session, I think you're going to see a bunch of bills, probably more bills than any other topic. You're going to all over the place. It's not just going to be data centers and energy policy related to that, or transmission lines, which is a hot topic too. But how do we incentivize new in-state generation? And it's not just going to be solar and offshore wind. Nuclear is going to be part of the answer. I think it's, you know, no greenhouse gas emissions. It's making a major comeback in the United States all over the place. There's some federal incentives to get it going. 40% of the power right now in Maryland comes from Calvert Cliffs, and most Marylanders don't even know we have a nuclear power plant, right? So nuclear is going to be part of it. And then also I think natural gas is going to be part of our future, but we've got to get more in-state generation.
The other thing I would add to though, this is another area of potential Trump disruption, because the policies that were enacted during the last 4 years on clean energy, on fighting climate change, on all those areas can be blown up by the Republican Congress and the Trump administration. So as in Medicaid, which I mentioned earlier, as in other areas, the Trump disruption factor is a big risk.
I would say one other hot issue in the same lane would be siting of energy. Okay, so in Ocean City, they don't like offshore wind. In the ag communities, in the farming communities, they don't like solar arrays. And so we have another problem is even if we want to do in-state generation, we incentivize, where can we build the new generation? And that is going to be a big issue this session as well. You know, there's going to be several bills on that topic. So keep an eye out on that subject, separate from the budget, but an important one for our state moving forward.
Very typically, clean energy has required government support. We don't have the money for providing that budget support. So given the fact that the Trump administration might be inimical to this, are we really going to move on this?
The way we've structured in Maryland, it hasn't been general fund money backstopping. It's been ratepayer money. Now, that's going to be a conversation we're also going to have. Is the ratepayer money been deployed properly over the last, since we created the so-called renewable portfolio standard back in 2004, it's been the ratepayers sort of subsidizing, particularly when it comes to wind and solar. And that, you know, has that been a good deal for the state of Maryland or for ratepayers? Similarly, we deregulated the energy industry of Maryland. That's going to, we're going to have a take a conversation look here about whether we're going to let the utilities get back into the generation game, back on this issue of we need more generation. Well, right now in Maryland, unlike Virginia, you know, your PEPCOs and your BGs cannot be in the generation business. Maybe we should rethink that.
Senator Roosevelt, last thoughts on what other bills that you want to see?
One of the most interesting bills from my point of view this session, the governor, as part of his legislative package, is going to have an apprenticeship initiative to try to deal with our broken labor market. And I've been working with him on that. I'm very encouraged the governor wants to take a lead on that.
Senator Feldman?
Well, for me, since we also deal with election law, as recently as last night, we yet again have a central committee appointing a new state senator to District 30 for this Congresswoman Elfers seat. We have Senator Jill Carter has resigned, and we're going to have to fill that seat. There may be other shoes to drop potentially on that front. Last session, we passed out of the state Senate, out of my committee and the full Senate, almost unanimously, a special elections bill that takes it away from central committees, the legislative vacancy issue, and puts it in the hands of voters. And it's stalled in the House. I think some of the opposition on the House side has indicated that they now will support the proposal. So I'm cautiously optimistic that finally, we will pass a special elections bill, which will then put it on the ballot in 2026, as it requires a constitutional change.
We'll make voters great again.
Yeah.
Brian Feldman, Jim Roosevelt, thank you for taking the time. Good luck in the session.
Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you.
There you have it. The coming debate in the Maryland Senate over taxes and much more. Between last week's episode with House Majority Leader David Moon and Environment and Transportation Chair Mark Corman, and now Senator Brian Feldman, Chair of the Senate Education, Energy, and Environment Committee, and Senator Jim Roosevelt, Vice Chair of the Budget and Taxation Committee, you pretty much have the legislative lay of the land. The politics will shift fast once Governor Moore presents his budget January 15th, but we now have the map of the ground we stand on. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, with support from University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from a century ago. This is a tune called Limehouse Blues from 1924 by the Carl Fenton Band. Usually we feature local music on the show. If you want to share your music or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time.